To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
You heard the song, so you know who we are. This is all I can say is you think you own this, but you do not. I'm Don.
Ooh, that's a good one considering what we were just talking about. Hey guys, it's Rook.
That's right. We're not going to tell you what we were just talking about, but it was unpleasant.
Much happier lives the two of us lead these days with our chosen career paths. Yeah.
No, not that they were ever bad, but it's sometimes things come up and you think, well, okay, sometimes you decide to make a chance. Sometimes the change is put upon you. If that ever happens in your life, just keep going forward. You know, you just keep pushing forward and things get better. Whether you stay at the same job, change jobs, change life.
Everything happens for a reason, you know, as cliche as that sounds. But I think the two of us overall, we were having this really wild conversation just now. But our stress levels are so, while we still have stress, it's not the same way. It's not the same level. It's not the same thing. And I hope it shows in the show. We have a lot more fun these days. We miss Dallas and Al, but, you know, that's part of life. It changes. So,
but they weren't the stress.
They were not the stress. I wanted to say that, you know, that we do miss those guys. You know, they're not the stress, but, you know, we hope that our fun comes out in the show because we really are having fun doing this for you guys. So
I'll say I miss Al. I don't miss Dallas so much.
Yeah, you know, Dallas, I could take him or leave him.
He does all the shows, so he'll hear this.
Yeah, you know what's funny is, like, I can't tell you. So recently my wife and I were in St. Augustine for our anniversary.
Yeah,
I
think congratulations I said that last again.
Time. Thank you. Came across this place called Wolf's, okay? Yeah. And it's like this museum sale. You can buy pretty much anything in the place, but it's also kind of like this museum history thing of, like, everything, like, horror-related, freak show-related.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's this wild place. I really, all I could think of was, oh, my God, Al would love this.
If you're not familiar with it, San Augustine is up in North Florida on the East Coast.
It is the oldest city in America.
Yeah, oldest occupied city in America. It was founded by the Spanish. The French had it for a while. Spanish had it again. English had it. I think the Spanish had it again. And then it became part of the United States. But it's an old fort made out of
coquina stone.
Yeah. Which is basically very seashells.
Rare, very rare stone. Only 3 quarries in the entire world have coquina.
Okay.
And there's a tremendous amount of it used. The fort, it doesn't look as big as it is.
Yeah.
And like, even when we went into the fort, we're like, oh, wow, this is way smaller. And then you got on top of the fort, and it's like, holy crap, this thing's huge.
It is. It's neat to see. And, yeah. But the town's next to it that came up because of the fort, of course, and it's an old place. It's got a history to it, but the thing that gets me every time I go there and I take a tour, it's a lot of crazy rich people that started competing against each other.
I cannot even begin to tell you how true that is. So Mel and I, we absolutely fell in love with the city. Okay, and we would have loved to have bought a place while we were there if we could have, because, you know, we're filthy rich. the one house that I saw that was absolutely gorgeous, $680,000. Okay, and this place is run down, beat up, front porch collapsed, the whole entire yard needs to be redone. I mean, this thing needs work. I mean, hard work. $680,000.
Well, they tell you the whole story about these super millionaires that made money on railroads and steel and lumber and all this stuff. And They bring in Tiffany to do glass for their windows and stuff in their hotel.
Tiffany Glass throughout the Flagler. Flagler College is in the city. I mean, it's right there. I mean, it's like tourists and college kids. That's all you get there. And Flagler College takes up a large chunk of the property around the place. Tiffany stained glass worth millions.
Yeah.
And do you know where that glass is? What that room is?
No.
It's the college cafeteria.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. These college kids sit there eating their lunch staring at millions of dollars worth of stained glass every day. Covered on both sides with bulletproof glass.
Wow. Well, they have it changes every time I go there, but they used to have a restaurant that was in a swimming pool, which at the time, this is in the 80s, I just wanted to eat there, but my wife and I didn't have enough money, so we just skipped it. There's a bunch of little museums you can go see, and my favorite one was, there was one guy that got rich doing hobby magazines. You know, model building, gun collecting, engraving.
Uh-huh.
But his whole line, this is back when magazines, you had like 50 billion magazines everybody got. And he felt bad that he did all these magazines on people and their hobbies, but he didn't have one himself. So he went around the world buying people's collections.
Yeah.
And he has a museum of collections. And they have music boxes, and I think it was three times a day, at certain times, they played all the music boxes all at once. And they said, that's something to hear. You know, I think they did it at 10 o'clock, at noon, at 3 o'clock.
I don't remember seeing that at all, or the restaurant in the pool, but doesn't surprise me, because I tell you what, we walked up and down the street so many times, and each and every time we saw something incredibly different, and just it was wild walking around that place.
I think it changes all the time.
Yeah.
Now, every time I went there, they did have the museum, but the restaurant, the pool, that was sometime in the 80s, and I haven't seen it since. But they used to have a Woolworths. So I guess that's gone now.
Yes, that's long gone, but the stores that occupy that building, still have the Woolworths door handles on them.
Oh, I got you. It was a little tiny one, but what I liked about it, we take those tours. You get those little buses and you pop off.
Yep.
And it was so hot. This is when my daughter was small. And at the Woolworths, they had a lunch counter like they used to when I was a kid. And they had ices. And we sit there drinking ices, trying to cool off, and people come in to get grilled cheese sandwiches. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. That was funny.
Yeah, and there's an awesome place in there in St. Augustine that makes these, I have no better word to call them than gourmet popsicles. The first day that I got one, I got a mango and habanero. I mean, come on. I can't tell you how good this thing is. It's amazing. Ghost tours, all kinds of, oh my God, just so many things to see. Museums, the Pirate Museum is there, the Medieval Torture Museum is there. I mean,
it's a wild place, and if you're looking for a place to go, it's up north from us, but it's worth seeing, and it's interesting, and you can spend some time there, and Jacksonville's not far from it.
Yeah.
And you can go down to the Space Coast, which is awesome, so, you know. Anyway, well, I've got something I want to talk about. Anybody listening to the show knows I really like this creator a lot. Howard Chaykin. Are you familiar with his work?
From you.
Okay. Howard Chaykin, to me, started popping up in D.C. in the early 70s. He was working on he did Iron Wolf on Weird Worlds, which at the time, Weird Worlds, that Tarzan Presents Weird Worlds, and it was all the Burl stories, John Carter, Mars, you know, that kind of stuff. At the Earth's Core, the Pellucidor stories. But he created and wrote and drew Iron Wolf. And since then he's gone on, done other stuff. His own character that he used to do for Star Reach magazine and later in Heavy Metal was Cody Starbuck. And then he did a series of four graphic novels on science fiction stories. Was that guy Alan Zelentes, the science fiction writer? My Star is My Destiny. He did a bunch of those.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Zelenta. Oh, crap. I can't think
okay,
of it.
Well,
I know who you're talking
you're
about.
You're just doing that so I don't feel bad because I couldn't say the name. But anyway.
Well, I can't say it. Come
just,
on.
Just
we
go.
Can't say names here?
We'll go to the blog and, you know, I noticed that Dallas and Al don't really have any trouble with this, but I do.
Thanks for leaving us here, you bums.
But every time I do that, I'm having trouble, and either usually it's Dallas goes, Don, I think it's this, and Al's like, yeah.
I can't pronounce crap.
But he did some beautiful work. A lot of people in Rook's generation would know that Marvel did a Star Wars comic book.
Mm-hmm.
Actually came out before the movie. Well, Howard Chaykin was the one that did it. Wasn't his best work. Saying that, Dallas loved it. But I was upset because I was interested in the movie. You know, the comics came out before the movie came out. And I was like, wow. And I'd get one. Oh, my God, what is this? It didn't, and then I see Cody Starbuck, and I thought, why didn't he do something like this? Anyway, my favorite Howard Chaykin work was American Flag. He did it in the early 80s. He's gone on, has done The Shadow for DC for a while, which is incredible. He did...
he's done so much. He's
done Black Hawk.
Batman stuff, DC. He did... He's known for doing the Bite Club series as well, which actually, did we ever talk about Bite Club on here? Or is that something
I don't even know what that is.
Okay, Bite Club is a comic book miniseries, like vampires and stuff. You know,
did he draw it or he write it?
He wrote it.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'm pretty sure we talked about that at Yancey Street a lot when it came out, so maybe that's why. But Captain America, X-Men, I mean, you know, he's done all kinds of stuff.
The one thing that happened with Howard Chaykin, when I'm telling you this, and I've already said it, he's an artist. He does write his own work, but to me, he's an artist that writes.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a period where, in the late 80s, I think it was on CBS, there was a Flash TV show. Did you ever watch it when you were a kid?
Yep.
And I saw the, I think it was a pilot. I think it was like it was an hour-long show, but I don't know if the pilot was 2 hours or if it was an hour, but I was kind of surprised because I love the Flash comic. So I was watching it. To me, it just didn't hold the magic the comic had, but my wife was watching it with me because, honey, this is good. Well, yeah, the actor was John Wesley Shipp. Now I think about it. Anyway, I never saw another episode. I guess I worked nights at the time, so I guess they showed it on a weekend, and then after that it switched to a night, and I never saw it.
Yeah, he actually wrote 9 episodes.
Yeah, well, I think, besides writing, I think he was some type of, he was in creative control of it. I know Walt Simonson on Fantastic Four dedicated his book to Howard Chaykin, what was it? I think he said the director of Flash TV show.
Mm-hmm.
He had a lot to do with it. Since then, he went on and did a lot of he was did the same thing on a show called Mutant X.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of others. And he made a joke about it that he was successful at working on television shows that he never watched in regular life. He's got a backhanded sense of humor. But after that, he started writing all the time. Instead of drawing, he just wrote stories. And they were very successful, popular ones. I read a couple. He wrote with Mike Mignola, the Fafnir and Gray Mouser. They were Fritz Lieber stories. DC did those in the early 70s as a book called Sword and Sorcery. And I bought all those. I liked Howard Chaykin. And he also did with Mike Mignola, Iron Wolf, again, which is something that Howard Chaykin created for DC in the early 70s, and him and Mike Mignola did kind of a graphic novel trade. But sometime in 2010, 2012, he started drawing again. But there was stuff like Nick Fury and Wolverine, which I wasn't really interested in. He did Avengers 1959. Which was a miniseries I liked, and after that he started on his own. He brought back the book Black Kiss, He did a second series of that, and, you know, other stuff that we've talked about, Satellite Sam. You know, I like Howard Chaykin. Anyway, he's got a series that I just picked up called Read It, Rook.
Hey, Kids Comics.
Now, the cover, that's Howard Chaykin on the front cover. It's a photograph of him. He's got a whole bunch of comics in front of him, and read the caption.
Too many to sign. Who do you think had to carry him here? It's a whole bunch of comic books laid across.
And it's all the same one.
Yeah, it's Powerhouse. All Powerhouse.
Now, the Powerhouse is drawn by Howard Chaykin. It's a Superman-like character. And it's got the old DC logo on it. And it looks like an old DC comic.
The buttons he's wearing, I Grok Hentai. If you get to cosplay, I get to stare.
Yeah. One thing about Howard Chaykin, I saw him in Dallas in 1982, and I was, I'll be honest with you, I was a little afraid, because I've read things he said, and the pictures I've seen, he dresses pretty sharp, he's got a style. His artwork, I thought, was fantastic, so I was already a little intimidated. Very nice, very approachable, you know, he knew... I would think you want to be on your best behavior with him. He could just kind of got that vibe. But one thing he was saying, he was in a panel and we went to listen, and he talked, and he's not afraid to give you his opinions. But he said, well, anybody got anything to ask? And everybody's quiet and listened to him. And, you know, this is in Dallas, Texas. And he said, everybody here's so nice. And I didn't really understand what he was talking about. You guys are so nice. And he started talking about New York, which is where he's from.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, he's at conventions and he's drawing things or signing things for people. They're standing there, not giving him any space and putting down what he's doing. Oh, you don't know what you're doing. What are you doing over here? I asked you to do this. And
yeah.
He says, people in New York act like they're doing you a favor by standing in your space. Well,
yeah.
It's a different place. Texas is wide open plains. You know, it's wide. Everybody's got plenty of space. New York is not the same.
Yeah, there is no space in New York.
But, anyway, so that's kind of what he's bagging on. And the position he's got is funny. But it's a photograph. I heard him on Word Balloon, a really great podcast. And he was talking about this book he's excited about, but he's telling a story of comics. It starts out in 1967, even though it's still drawn in this 1920s-looking American flag, you know, jazz style.
Yeah.
But it starts out with all these people going to this gala event. And the woman's talking. She's all excited. And this old man, let's see, what was they say? She's saying to her husband, excited, honey. It's a young woman with this older guy in a tux. And all of a sudden, she says, it's wonderful. Who knew a Broadway musical? And the guy's like, yeah, but the TV show paid off quicker. And then it's kind of tattered old man comes up and says his name, and he says, Irwin. He goes, Mr. Hershenson. Is there a problem here? That's what the police say. Anyway, the old man's talking. He says, how's it been? Been better. A lot of that going around. Heard about Ira, yeah. Anyway, he slips him a roll of money, and he goes on. And anyway, she's talking about that was nice of him giving him money. And then she says, he recognized you. He goes, fine, sure. Guy used to work for me way back when. Did he ever work on Powerhouse? Work on it. Him and his dad partner made the thing up. And she has this look of disbelief, like, what? Well, then it switches to 1945. And it's got two creators, which... One thing about this book, he's thinly disguising... As you already see, he's disguising the comics industry...
Gee, do you think this represents Stan Lee?
Yeah, yeah, it does.
I mean, yeah, he's definitely...
But see, some of this is obvious, but some of it, like these two men, one's white, one's black in 1945. They just got out of the military.
Mm-hmm.
One's Ray Clark, and the other one is Ted Whitman. I don't know who these guys are. And that's one thing that spoiled it. I'm trying to figure out who they're supposed to be. But the Stan Lee character's in it. But to me, at first, he's not instantly recognizable. There's a Jack Kirby type part here. Now, saying this, I'm not an inside guy in the comic industry. Howard Chaykin was there. There's a Gil Kane character who Howard Chaykin was assistant to, and, you know, Gil Kane was his mentor. he's basically seen these people as they really are, not through a filter like I saw, where they're bigger than life. But I've got two issues of this book we're thumbing through. It's kind of genius how he switches from time period to time period. It goes from the 60s to the 40s to the 50s when the Wortham hearings are starting. It all talks about all the back stuff. It goes back to 60s. It switches around. It starts telling stuff about Gil Kane's escapades with women, you know.
Yep.
He was banging married women after married women. It's got a, I'm thinking one of these women, not that he was banging her, but it's Marie Severin, who we just lost from Marvel. And it switches all the way up to the 2000s. Neil Adams is there, which I really like how he did him. But
yeah, it's really kind of funny looking at this. I'm kind of getting the vibe for who some of these people are supposed to be.
Yeah, so. Some of it you can get a vibe. Some of it, it's... I'm not quite sure, and to me that kind of pulled me out of it. And he's got his,
but I think that's part of the fun of this book is, you know, trying to figure out who the F he's talking about.
Well, I was hoping there'd be a key or something. The second book has a little bit of a backstory.
Maybe you just got to keep reading.
Yeah,
you know?
And the second issue has a headshot,
has a key of characters,
but
yeah.
It doesn't say exactly who they are, and like.
Well, and I doubt that you'll ever get him to say exactly who they are, and maybe he's making up some of these characters to just completely throw shit off, people off, pardon me.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's an interesting book because he's sowing an argument between him and, someone and another artist about, ripping him off.
Now here's,
which we all know is a standard.
Exactly. It's a standard. And, here's one key. When Gil, when Rook said, maybe we could call you Gil. when Rook said, the Stan Lee character, the Stan Lee character is definite, and it's Bob Rose. It's not Stan Lee, it's Bob Rose. And it's not Marvel Comics, it's Verve Comics.
Yeah. And, but there is no denying what he's pointing at there.
Now, DC is national. DC used to be called National Comics, and there was American Comics. And
right.
There's the same owner. He combined them, and he called them National Periodical Publications. The comics itself had a DC on it because of the Detective Comics, which was their first
which
one.
Which was, yeah, because they were detective-styled comics.
Yeah, but that was the first one. And anyway, they later, God, I think it was in the 80s when they actually changed the name to DC Comics. So anyway, but in this one, it's Yankee.
Yeah.
Yankee Comics. Well, yeah, for National Yankee, I kind of see that.
Yeah.
But, so it has that key, but, oh, and Neil Adams is Tom Hollenbeck. But that, to me, was kind of pulling out, but I got these yesterday. I heard him talk about this last summer on the podcast. I asked my store if they'd get it for me. I guess I'm the only person getting it. And
yeah.
He said, all right, two issues are out. I'll get them for you in 2 weeks. So when I got off work yesterday, I ran to the store, picked them up, and I read through these. Like, Howard Jenkins stuff doesn't read fast. You know, some creator, Alan Davis, it doesn't matter who writes it. When you get an Alan Davis comic, you can read that thing in 10 seconds. He just flows, it's smoother than glass, and they're not simple. But Howard Jenkins books, they're dense, there's a lot to them. And no matter what it is, it takes you a while to read them. So saying that, I read through both of these last night. I like them. I think it's a four-issue series. I was thinking, but I didn't have time. I was wanting to look it up on a computer and see if somebody's going to tell thick-headed me exactly who all these people are. But I highly recommend it. Now, I imagine this is going to be a trade when it's finished. I highly recommend picking the thing up because... To me, comic books is a wonderful world that I enjoy to no end, and it's a fun, bigger-than-life, fantastic world. But in reality, it was not. And that's why they're talking about this, is these people are getting screwed. Some of them go work at in different industries that require artwork.
Yeah.
And like I said, Jerry Robinson, last episode, was a comic illustrator, comic artist, and creator. He ended up becoming... a political cartoonist. They're quite successful. And but a lot of these guys ended up going to work for magazines or getting out of completely going to advertising, which they show this is what some of these people did. And but some of them didn't. You know, they even bring up the Jack Kirby character that basically he was the architect of it, but he wasn't getting the residuals or anything, and he knew it, but he never left. And they show Jack Kirby as
Wait a minute. I just realized something about these books.
What's that?
Where's the credits here? Where? Apparently, Will Quintana is working on this with him.
Look in the first issue. Right there.
Yeah, he's the colorist. All right. Name stands out, and I wanted to bring that to light because Will is actually somebody who's been to Yancey Street Comics for Free Comic Book Day and some other things like that. So I almost want to say he's a local.
Really?
I almost want to say he's a local in our area. I may be wrong on that one. I may be way off on that one. But yeah, I've actually met him. Really nice guy. Really, really nice guy.
You know, one thing when you bring this up, I do want to clarify. I tried to give credit on the blog to all the people that worked on the comics. And what I ended up doing was always give credit to the writer, the penciler, and the inker.
Mm-hmm.
I rarely give credit to the letterer. And I don't think, except when we talk about Jordy Belair or certain colorists, I ever give a colorist credit. Bleeding Cool every year has a bunch of panels from the San Diego podcast they record, which is awesome. And I've posted them on the show. Highly recommend it. I love it when they do that. But they had a panel of, like, I don't know, 7-8 colorists, comic colorists. And then basically they talk about their unsung. They're not noticed. They don't get the, you know.
Yeah.
I can tell you a lot of colorists. Adrienne Roy was a popular one in the 70s. I remember when I met Britt in college, we both wanted to be cartoonists. And he said he met a girl and he thought it was odd that her goal was to become a comic book colorist. And Britt just looked like, okay.
Like, why? Well, but the color has a lot to do with the story.
Well,
I mean, you can change the whole. Dallas and I have had this conversation about the Batman killing joke.
Yes.
I think it was him that has one of the updated prints.
I thought you had it.
Did I have the updated print? I don't know. One of us has an updated
print. No, you bought the updated print.
I bought an updated, the like anniversary edition or something.
Yeah.
And we went through it page by page and looked at the variation in the colors and how it changed the feel of the story.
Well, that's
it really that, does.
We
color
did
is extremely important.
That's been talked about by us on several of these episodes. If you type it on the blog in the search book, Killing Joke Color, these mm-hmm. pop up because we have samples of what Rook's talking about, the old one and the newer one.
Yeah, we put them side by side so we could really see what the difference was. And I think we actually went through the book, maybe we didn't do it on the show, but we went through that book together page by page looking at the variations. So, it's extremely important.
Well, sometimes it can jar, but Al and I talked about this last episode, Marie Severin. She started out as a colorist for EC Comics. And one thing Al brought up was that some of those EC comics really went beyond the pale with the horror and the crime comics that they were doing. And he said that Marie Severin, certain things when she called her like really hideous things, she called them with dark colors where you wouldn't notice them quite so much. Mm-hmm. You know, she was I guess you could say some of censorship, but you could still see it. But you can kind of control the whole mood and storytelling the story. And there's times, even old comics on newsprint, I remember just thrilling to the colors they used. And they were talking about how they're always the last to get credit for something. And when I say that, I completely understand that. It's just time restraints. I don't want to credit every single person on the blog. But I do think you're wonderful, and a good colorist can make or break a comic book. Because one complaint I've got, comics coloring, I think, is the improvement from the early 90s, you know, with comics coloring from what came before, except for European comics, is incredible. But some of these people over-render things. They lose the cartoonist lines.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, this one right here, that what I like about the coloring on this is it's good rendered coloring and it's strong coloring, but Howard Chaykin's lines are put on top of the colors, which is how I think it should be.
Yeah.
Barry Smith did Conan in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
and Dark Horse put them out in color on really nice trades, but they didn't put the lines on top, and they got too muddy, and I just really upsets me. You know,
once again we go back to printing errors as well. That's a printing error that can happen too, having the lines underneath, because the lines hold everything together.
Yeah.
So if you're putting the color above the lines, on top of the lines, then you're creating that bleed for the ink. So it's important to have that break. So, but yeah, it's yeah. I just thought that was funny. A little add on to that piece that Will Quintana is Quintana. Excuse me. I butcher names. I'm sorry, everybody.
We all do. We're your long friends.
Is working on that piece as well.
That's nice. Well, on this one, the first issue, the back cover is Powerhouse, which is definitely Superman.
Oh, yeah.
The second issue is an advertisement for 6 EC Comics, but it's GW.
You see that?
Graham Wood, which is the supposed to be. What's that guy? All of a sudden, I can't leave his name. The one that created EC.
This is totally great.
Al's screaming at the radio right now.
Al is probably screaming at us.
What's
right
that guy's name? Gaines. Bill Gaines. Bill Gaines. Bill Gaines. Sorry, Al. But I don't know. It's fun.
Hey, you know what? Maybe if we screw up enough stuff about horror comics, Al will come back. Let's keep screwing it up.
Anyway, while I'm talking about that, I've been wanting to talk about this Free Comic Book Day. I went to Yancey the Rook. I had had two of these issues I found at Yancey. Hysteria.
Yes.
Now, Hysteria, I bought two issues I saw at Yancey and never saw any other. And on Free Comic Book Day, they have those, which I think is nice. Well, they'll take the entire series and put it in one plastic bag and give you a price.
Yep.
So I got I think there's 6 issues. Yeah, I got all 6 issues for a lower price. Hysteria got really popular because one cover offended a lot of people. I didn't know what the cover was. It ended up being a young man hung out in the street. You know,
really?
Yeah, he's a hangman's noose. Got a lot of flack for it. The first issue I've got, it's a woman in a burqa and a veil, but it's Stars and Stripes.
Yep.
And it says, The Divided States of Hysteria by Howard Chaykin, which basically tells you all you need to know in today's climate.
Yeah, absolutely. This is this goes back to some of our conversations had earlier. You know,
people. Now, Howard Chaykin's not afraid to give you his mind. But
that's kind of one of the great things about him. I mean, you know, it's he is not going to. Oh, hey, guess what? Cover colorist. Will Quintana. Will again.
But that's what but Howard Chaykin thinks things out. He gives you his opinion, and like I said, he's a creator I really enjoy. When I see him, I grab him. The work, not him. But one thing reading Hysteria, he always tends to have some of the same characters, you know, kind of a seedy, wisecracking, tough guy, you know, that's, to me, kind of an anti-hero. In this book, a big disaster occurs, and for what's left of the world, he has to, he was going to prison. And then when whatever this disaster happened, they pulled him out, and then he had to put together his own task force. And he basically got these people out of prison. And it shows what happens and why the people were put in. All different ethnic people, different types of people. And one of them, I kept thinking is a girl, and it's a guy. But, you know, he wants to be a girl.
Yep. I just got to that scene.
Yeah, he's not afraid to play with uncomfortable subjects. And not just play with them, stick them in your face and play around with them. But reading this series, the one thing I want to say, I've always loved Howard Chaykin as an artist. I like it when he writes his own stories, but I didn't realize, really strong writer. Saying that, I know he wrote for possibly 10 years without drawing for other people, so that tells you he's a good writer. But this one, I realized he can really take complex subjects and make you understand them pretty quickly. And his characters definitely have their own personalities. You believe the characters, even if you don't like them. I guess I always took it that his drawing was what made you think that. But when reading these, I realized this is writing. I'm not going to tell you everything about the story. I do recommend it. If you do like Howard Chaykin, if it's not a taste you like, stay away from this thing with, you know, everything you got. And the ending, I kind of found shocking. But he's not afraid to,
to twist things. He's definitely not worried about... he's telling a story whether you like the story or not.
That's a good way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, saying this, as I just said, Howard Chaykin's one of those people I buy right up. For Vortex Comics, which is the ones that did the Annoying Post Brothers, which I loved, and Mr. X, which I loved, Howard Chaykin did a book called Black Kiss, which I mentioned earlier.
Yep.
Now, that was... that one had a lot of criticism. And before it even came out, but it came polybagged. That's the first book I'd ever seen polybagged.
Well, I was going to say, if I recall, that book is a little... I hate to use this word because it sounds critical. Gratuitous.
Oh, it went beyond the pale, as I would say.
Yeah.
It was a black and white book.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish, again, Howard Chaykin is really good at black and white. But it came polybagged, and I think it was only 16 pages, maybe, or no, it wasn't even, I think, it was short, 12 pages or something like that, but it was more expensive than getting a regular alternative comic, like Fantagraphics.
Yeah.
Just explain, DC Comics in the 80s at this time were 75 cents. If you bought a book from Fantagraphics, like Usagi Jimbo, it was $2, which is, you know... Love and Rock and Souls kind of books are, you know, more than a regular DC or Marvel comic, mainstream comic. But this one was like $2.75. It's more expensive than any of these books, and not as much story. I mentioned it to Britt, and he said it was like buying a pamphlet. And it was a sexy book. It was a porn book.
Yeah.
And he said he liked drawing it. I bought the first issue. I was kind of on the fence of ever buying another one. I probably would have, but I never saw another one. And I didn't realize how long it went on. But when he started drawing again, he was on... I can't think of what podcast is on, but he was talking about it. I think it was a sidebar, which... He said he did it, and he was really happy with it. I guess he finished the story, and I guess they put it out as a trade. And he was kind of irritated that nobody bought it. Well, nobody saw it, really. I have a feeling the one issue I saw was somebody had it in their subscription box and they stopped going to the store, so they just threw it out on the wall. But he did a Black Kiss too. Again, never seen it.
Yeah.
But like I said, he loves doing it. But that one, I think that's only for the strong. But like I said, Hysteria, I read it. I liked it. One thing that Ken Brusnak is the letterer on all these, from American Flag on up. And he's a letterer, but he's a really strong collaborator because he goes with Howard Chaykin stuff. The lettering is a character in all of these books.
Oh, yeah. There's bits of lettering in the backgrounds and everything. And
yeah, what he's trying to draw is white noise in today's society. You've always got stuff going on, and to me, sometimes it's a bit distracting, which I think is what they wanted you to do.
Yeah, I definitely think it's meant to be distracting. It's meant to pull you away and have to make you rethink where you were.
Right. It was intentional. Well, it was successful. But, like I said, they're always putting in any kind of digital media. The media is a big thing in a lot of Howard Chaykin's, well, not all of it, but some of his stuff. Anyway, fantastic story. I just thought, I've been wanting to talk about Hysteria, but since we talked about Hey Kids Comics...
Yep, absolutely.
He's doing one of those Hanna-Barbera DC books. There's an old character that I remember as a small kid called Rough and Ready. And old Hanna-Barbera comics, but he does it. I think it's supposed to be the comic industry again. He wrote it. Somebody else drew it. But he was really excited about that, talking about a word balloon. I've seen them, but I've never read them. But I know you liked some of those DC Hanna-Barbera books at the beginning.
Yeah. Some of them are still going. Scooby-Doo Apocalypse is still on the run.
I heard somebody talking about that. It's not normally in the comic store, and they just think those are the greatest books in the world.
They are interesting. I got to tell you, they are very interesting. And you know, I don't talk a lot about them because they're, you know, it's such a far cry from what Scooby-Doo everybody's used to. So, but it's definitely worth reading. I got to tell you, you know, God, I forget what issue they're on now, but they're up there for they're up there now. And in order to get them, I mean, you probably want to get them in trades at this point. So, well, hey, why don't we take a music break here, and we're going to get right back to you guys.
All right.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
Your Dimension can be found on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe, rate, leave a review, tell a friend, or like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.
And that was DigiCrack Super Drum with Smoke and Mirrors. Once again, playing that one for you guys. Very cool band. Very much a fun something to go check out. I think Earth Dance is actually happening either this weekend or next, and they're performing there again.
They're very visual, yeah, as we talked about before.
Very, very visual band.
Now, are they playing just around here? Are they playing in other parts of the...
No, they just did a big tour. I think they did an East Coast tour, and then they're, like I said, Earth Dance is a festival, and I believe... I cannot remember for the life of me if Earth Dance is this weekend or next weekend. Or it may have even been last weekend. I don't know. I've lost track of time. But, yeah, they just played Earth Dance as well. So, or by the time this episode comes out, they would have played it.
So look them up. They may show up in a town near you.
Absolutely. Keep your eye out for them, kids.
Very nice. All right. And I guess it's time
for...
Palooza! Okay, I want to say something. When we talked about doing this, I got a pile of random comics I brought in. Rook said, hold on, let me get some. He goes through these massive file cabinets he does with his eyes closed. And he's pulling out, so I'm not trying to influence. And he's just pulling from all over. And I'm thinking, and I said, you're not going to be mad when you have to put all these back. Because, I mean, to me, that's a job. He's got several of them. He has no idea we took them, so I'm going to be totally mad. So
I have no idea what I've got. I literally, eyes closed, open drawer. I think I grabbed like two or three out of each drawer. This is going to be fun.
So. Well, that's how it should be. So anyway, let me grab one of yours and we'll start it off.
All right.
So
go for it.
I'm going to grab from the center here. Okay, I've got... The Infinity Gauntlet, number 4.
I cannot remember a damn thing about this book.
It's by Dustin Weaver and Jerry Duggan.
I will tell you that this is actually not the original Infinity Gauntlet storyline. This is a newer one. Let's see, what year was this? This was probably... let's go ahead and open her up and find out, kids.
I was scared to open it.
Nope, we're going to open it right on up. This is definitely a newer book. Oh, yeah, okay, now I'm remembering this book. The minute I open it, 2015, Infinity Gauntlet.
Oh, it's just recent.
Yes, this is the new Infinity Gauntlet storyline. Why do I not remember this? This family has the Nova Force, I remember that. They're building they've got the Infinity Gauntlet in their hands. Good Lord, why do I not remember any of this? That's ridiculous. I think I need to reread this book. I am ashamed right now. Wow, I can usually tell you all kinds of crazy stuff about the books I have, but there's this whole family right now in this storyline that has the Infinity Gauntlet, the Nova Force spread throughout them, and they all have the Nova armor and everything, and they're, if I remember correctly, they're attempting to collect the Infinity Gems into the Gauntlet. And, of course, you know, Thanos is doing his thing, trying to stop them. And you've got all the others. You've got the Skrull. You have... well, here we go. There you go. Drax has just got his neck snapped. So, let's read the first page. This will tell you everything. The multiverse was destroyed. All that remains is battle. Oh, this is during Secret Wars. That's what this is. Okay.
The new Secret Wars.
The new Secret Wars, where everything was destroyed and the only thing that exists is Battle World, a massive patchwork planet composed of fragments of worlds that no longer exist. Basically, what Marvel did with this story system is they took all of their really, really great storylines and they stuck them all like next door to each other. But they didn't know they existed next door to... Not everybody knew they existed next door to each other.
Okay.
Okay? And this particular world is the Infinity Gauntlet storyline. So, Doom is actually a god and created all this himself. Each region is a domain unto itself. The dangerous colony of bloodthirsty bugs has swarmed a domain in Battle World. A young girl and her family were on the run until her mother, a long-lost Nova, returned and deputized them as members of the Intergalactic Peace Force. Now they're in search of the Infinity Stones, hoping to combine their powers to repel the bug scourge. Star-Lord, Gamora, you have Drax, obviously, because I said he got his neck snapped in this, and Thanos himself are all in this. So it's I don't know if I actually finished this collection or not, but this was one of those Secret Wars. Everything got really crazy during this time for Marvel. They took some really interesting concepts and storylines and started throwing them out there for everybody to read through, altering the histories and timelines of some of their greatest stories. So this was a fun thing that Marvel did with the Secret Wars, but a lot of this didn't stick. 99% of this didn't stick because they went back and the universe fixed itself, but in some very interesting ways that, you know, I don't really want to give away.
Well, I remember you talking about this with great enthusiasm when that stuff was coming out.
Yeah, it really was. It was really like the best part of it was the fact that you had these great storylines, like I said, that some of the best storylines Marvel's ever done, and they put them out there into these miniseries for everybody. So, all right, ready? Your turn.
All right, let's go.
Here we go, and we have. Oh, here we go. Future Quest presents Hanna-Barbera's Birdman.
Oh, that's a great one. I really enjoyed the Future Quest series. Now, I remember you looked at a couple and you said it wasn't for you.
It wasn't for me, but I did, you know. Of course, it's a classic Hanna-Barbera, so.
Now, the Hanna-Barbera, I was 5 and 6 years old when all these things, the Mighty Mitor, Space Ghost, Birdman, all this stuff was coming out. Frankenstein Jr., I think I was 4 when he came out. I love those. And the creators that did that book, I really enjoyed. I liked how they told the story where the Herculoids and all these people were all in, you know, how they all fit in together.
Yeah.
It was 12 issues. I ate it up. Scott Connor, one of the listeners of the show, he got it. Says, I'm really hoping for something more. Well, it wasn't as detailed as a story like Nexus or any of this other stuff or X-Men or anything, but to me, I was just enjoying it to no end. I liked the artwork kept changing. The artists kept changing, but Jeff Parker, I think, was the writer, and I really like his stuff. Anyway, yeah, Future Quest presents. I'd see it. I guess they had the Galaxy Trio for one, and they did 3 issues of Birdman, and Steve Rude drew them, which I'm a big Steve Rude fan. They were okay. They were kind of standalone stories, as I remember. They kind of continued, but that was my favorite one. This one issue right here, I just all the way through, I really had a good time. It felt like an old Birdman story. I love the artwork. It's funny because Birdman had the same voice as Gary Owen. It was Space Ghost voice.
Yep.
And it was a weird show because it came on early, I think on NBC. And as a kid on Saturday morning, you had 3 networks, and you'd basically watch one network, and then after you'd seen all those episodes, you'd just turn the channel and start watching the other network. And I just remember it came on really early in the morning. I turned it on. I said, wow, Birdman, what is this? Al wasn't even aware of it. When I told him, he's like, what? Since then, Adult Swim on Cartoon Network did Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law. Which my daughter thought was the greatest. And I do have to say I really like the theme song.
Yep.
So, all right, let's go back to Rook's pile.
All righty.
I'm going to go right in close to the bottom this time. Hack Slash.
Oh, all right. Hack Slash.
Hack Slash, watch the number.
All right. Issue number 17. This is cover B. So let's open this up because I don't remember precisely from the cover what this is. But
okay, now one thing. I hear the title Hack Slash all the time, and that's the extent of my knowledge. I know it's a popular book.
So, the storyline here is Casey Hack is the daughter of a slasher.
Okay.
Think classic Jason, Freddy, Michael Myers type characters. Okay. So, Casey's mother, because Casey was being made fun of in school, started cooking the kids in school. Into the school lunch. She was the lunch lady slasher. So, of course, she was killed. I think she, like, boiled her face in a vat or something like that. And then came back from the dead and continued her work. Casey being, you know, of great fortitude, came in and killed her own slasher mother. And since then has traveled the world fighting slashers. At one point, she runs across a character named Vlad, and Vlad was almost mistaken, which Vlad is actually the character on the cover of this book. She almost mistook Vlad for a slasher, and she found out he was not the slasher, but he was trying to hunt the slasher that she was looking for. So they've teamed up since and have traveled the world hunting down and destroying slashers. This particular issue, let's see. Looks like they're chasing a slasher like usual. Some kind of family of this is the family of slashers. This is some weird, creepy cannibal family where, like, they're all slashers. They're trying to tell Vlad, like, he's, like, one of them or some crap. Vlad won't tolerate it. Vlad doesn't fall for it. You can see here how one character transforms into her slasher form. This is a very interesting series because this got very popular very quick.
Yes.
People were talking about it becoming a television series or a movie or something to that effect. It's a really good read. Some of it's very campy, goofy, but later on, they actually started doing a lot of work with this to create a much deeper storyline in the series. And fun fact about this book, many parts of it take place in our very own Tampa, Florida. More specifically, Ybor City.
Really?
Yes. They do.
Yeah.
So Casey's girlfriend. Casey Hack meets a girl. The two of them are start a kind of tumultuous relationship, and the girl lives in Tampa, Florida.
Okay, one thing, if you're listening to this, is kind of a Florida history show. But Ybor City is the Cuban quarter out in Tampa, and they had a cigar rolling factory, which I don't know if it's the same, but they used to have cigars that said "Have a Tampa" on it.
Yeah. Nowadays, it's filled with nightclubs and bars, and it is the place to go in your 20-somethings to get drunk and other things.
It's a really beautiful place. I mean, they've restored it. It's always been, ever since I've lived here, they used to have guava ween. I don't know if they still do.
They still do guava ween, as far as I'm aware.
It's a big festival. They have all kinds of stuff there. I've been there a few times, even though I'm not a 20-something. But it's a nice place. But
there's a lot of beautiful history to Ybor City. The Cubans, the pirates. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that happens down there. Jose Gaspar, which is a pirate. We have Gasparilla down here.
Yeah.
Gasparilla, at least as far as I'm still aware, the Gasparilla Night Parade goes right through Ybor City.
Isn't there a ship that comes through, and that's supposed to be his ship?
Yeah, that's in the bay over off the bay shore and everything. But then with Guava Ween, we have the Mama Guava Stumble, where she, you know, does her thing down 7th Avenue and everything. So
I didn't know that.
No, yeah, that's a whole deal too. Mm. But yeah.
But when I moved here, it was Ybor City.
Yeah, it's never been Ybor City unless you just got here.
Yeah, it's like that sport, that high lie. Always read as Jaw Ollie.
Jaw Ollie, yeah. Yeah, yeah. You can always tell a tourist because they walk up to you and go, "Do you know how I can get to Ybor City?"
Yeah, well, that's what it reads.
Yeah, it's not in Tampa.
Listen.
Well, I understand it's in Tampa. No, we don't have a Ybor City. Never heard of it. I've actually done that to people. Standing in Ybor. and went and looked at them and went, I've never heard of Ybor City. And they're like, well, I thought we're like right near Ybor City, right? And I was like, no.
I don't know where you're from.
I don't know where you're looking for, but this isn't Ybor.
If you're not from here and you don't speak Spanish, you read it as Ybor, and you got to understand if they're tourists and they don't know, you don't have to make them feel bad. That might have been me you told me that. I never found the place.
Yeah, well, that was a jerk. What did I tell you? All right, ready?
Here we go again.
We're going to go from the top here. Let's go like only three in. All right. Oh, this looks like a little... Oh, man, that's a cool one right here.
Okay.
Ready for this? This is Marvel Comics Group. August issue number 16, The Mighty Thor, starring in Marvel Spectacular.
Oh, okay, this is one of the reprint books.
Yeah.
I found these at Yancey Street in the dollar box. Mm-hmm. I got three of these. I'm going to pull the other two out.
Oh, they're right up top, too.
Now, Marvel in the 70s had a series of reprint books, like Spider-Man was in Marvel Tales, and it was reprints of the old Spider-Man books. Fantastic Four was in Marvel's Greatest Comics, which is something I used to get a lot. And this is The Mighty Thor and Marvel Spectacular, which I don't remember running that long. The Mighty Thor has always been one of my favorite Marvel Comics. If I could be a character, it'd be the Mighty Thor. I just always liked him. I always thought he was noble. He was cool. Girls liked him, you know. I didn't like the fact that I'd turn into Don Blake if I didn't have the hammer, but nevertheless, you know.
You know, it's funny that they got rid of all of that. They really don't talk about the Donald Blake at all anymore. They just kind of eliminated that from the Thor history lines.
It was kind of neat when it started that he found the club and he turned into Thor, and then later kind of funny he really was Thor, and it was a curse that, or you know, it was a punishment that Odin put on him.
But they never talk about that stuff anymore. I mean, they don't really acknowledge any of it.
Well, when they did away with that was when, I don't know if it stayed that way, but when Walt Simonson was doing Thor, which is anybody listening to the show even for 5 minutes knows that I think those are some of the greatest comics ever done. But basically, Odin took that away and said that it's ran its purpose. It's because of Beta Ray Bill that he removed the curse, the enchantment. But the problem was he wanted to stay on Earth, so he had to create his own identity. And S.H.I.E.L.D. gave him an identity of Cigar Jarlson. And that was fun. And I never really read Thor much ever again, so I didn't know if what they'd done, but...
It's actually quite interesting what they've been up to with Thor lately in the books, with the multiple Thors, Thor the Unworthy, Jane Foster Thor, and then War Thor. There's actually a third Thor that showed up, and that third Thor was carrying the hammer of Ultimate Thor and became War Thor.
You know, it's I read that. I think it was an Alice Davis drawn book. It was a Secret Wars, Captain Britain. Mm-hmm. There's two issues of it. Alan Davis drew it. I think he might have written it, but it was tied into Secret Wars, and they had the three Thors. They had the Jane Foster Thor.
Mm-hmm.
The,
well, but see, they've been doing a lot of work with three Thors. Jason Aaron's been writing a lot with Thor, and he's been doing some amazing work. He did the three Thors, the young Thor, the current Thor, and old man Thor, where Thor is actually the king of Asgard on a desolate, destroyed Earth. So he did those three Thors, and then you have the Jane Foster Thor, or he's not really calling himself Thor, he's calling himself Odin's son, the unworthy Thor. And then you, in a storyline, what happened, okay. So if we go back to the Secret Wars, okay, which is this is an interesting thing that Jason Aaron's doing with Thor, or with a lot of the things he's writing. Jason Aaron is actually still paying attention to what happened in Secret Wars.
Okay.
And he's bringing some of those things in there. And something happened that caused Thor to become unworthy of the hammer. So he can't lift the hammer anymore. Jane Foster lifts the hammer and becomes the Jane Foster Thor, or the female Thor. Thor has lost his arm. He has, you know, he's been searching for...
This is unworthy Thor?
This is the unworthy Thor. He's been searching to try and restore his powers, and they found out that the Thor from Secret Wars, the Ultimate Thor, took his hammer and threw it, and somehow it broke through the reality strands, broke the barriers, and landed on Asgard. Which theoretically shouldn't have been possible because that reality didn't exist during Secret Wars, blah, 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 whatever. It still happened. It's a cool idea. So Thor, unworthy Thor goes to pick up the hammer, and the Ultimate Thor hammer has this cool thing where if you're unworthy, it's not that you can't lift the hammer. You die.
Wow.
You just flat out die. So Thor touches the hammer with his fingers, has all this like energy and surge and everything like that, but doesn't actually pick it up because as he says something to the effect of, this is not my hammer. And he walks away from it. Then later on, we see some mysterious figure pick up the hammer and declare himself War Thor. And interestingly enough, character that's seen in these books that you have here, it's Volstagg.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah! Yeah, it's Volstagg. Big old round Volstagg. Fun, loving, yeah. Oh,
he's
no.
War Thor.
Some very, very dark things happened. Maybe we should have wrote spoilers before this.
Oh, that's okay. It's old anyway.
Some very dark things happened to Volstagg prior to this, trying to defend some children, and they were all murdered in front of him. And the Ultimate Thor hammer basically, with all of that pain, corrupts his mind, and he becomes this War Thor that's just hell-bent on just killing everybody.
Well, that's not a nice Thor, and you're not worthy. Wow, that's something. Well, if I was Thor, I would never be unworthy Thor. I'd stay regular Thor, which is my favorite. Now, these are fun, though. I have to say, reprint books, but you know, these things... To me, they're just comic books. They're just chock full. I mean, you read it from... And Dan also said this about the X-Men books that Dave Cockrum and Chris Claremont wrote. But, you know, it's two stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just 22 pages of wonder for a quarter. You know what I mean?
One of the best things I love about that is they actually keep the original ads in there, too. All those old ads.
Yeah. Well, these are actually, they were new ads at the time.
These were new ads when this was printed?
Yeah.
Looked like the old ads, which would have been really cool.
Some of the ads, like the classified ads and stuff, and some of those where you sell seeds to get stuff, you know.
Yeah.
They didn't really change too much, but they were current ads at the time. I think these were done in the early 70s.
Yeah, 74.
Oh, yeah. God, it's a great year. I hit puberty then. but like I said, I pulled these out of Yancey. I read them. They're just fun. I'm saying that they're chock full of things, but sometimes the stories were written for an audience that changed over every 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
So if comics would have remained this way, a lot of us probably would have just... We'd always love the form, but we would have moved on, you know.
Yep.
Instead of them writing them for us and completely destroying the whole comics industry, and now they're wondering what's going to happen, we're all gone. but nevertheless, I like them, but there are things about now that I enjoy just as much. But nevertheless, these were fun books. All right, let's go. It's your turn.
Oh, boy.
I'm breaking the rules. I'm pulling directly off the top. Let's see what I got. Ooh. Child's Play, X-Force, number 33.
Oh, man, here we go. Let's take it. All right.
All right. You can see by the decibels of Rook that he is excited on this one.
So this is the Child's Play storyline. This is issue. This is number 3 of a 4-part storyline for X-Force. Okay? Let's go ahead and...
This
is one of those self-sealing bags. I hated these bags. Remember these bags?
Yeah, but they made sense. Sometimes I buy a back issue at a comic store...
But the thing that pisses me off with these self-sealing bags is the fact that, like, if you weren't really careful pulling your book out, it stuck to the book. Do you know how many books I tore because
of these self-sealing? I've done that with the tape thing.
Yeah, you know. But that, I don't know.
But yeah, this is hard to get out.
Yeah, it was all the way across the bloody thing. So right off the bat on the cover, you have Cable, Warpath, Shatterstar, which I know some of you just learned who Shatterstar was because of the Deadpool movie. And this appears to... Is that... let's open a book. Let's not just take a guess here. It is. It's Fitzroy. So Fitzroy was a character in the 90s that went up against the X-Force quite a bit. He was a mutant. I remember right, he was able to, like, gather charge, or, like, kinetic charge, and fire it back on his enemies. So, This appears to be... I don't remember the exact concept of the Child's Play storyline, but...
Is that Cable in the front?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Cable was the leader of X-Force at the time. X-Force was an outlaw band of mutants. Let's see, this one, they've come to the Guthrie family home in Cumberland County, Kentucky, in order to learn who has kidnapped their vacationing teammates, Cannonball and Boomer, which Cannonball and Boomer at the time were dating, I believe. The Guthrie family farm is Cannonball's family farm. These are some wild stylings to these characters.
Who was the artist on those?
I'm checking that right now. Let's see. Tony Daniel is the penciler. John Holdridge as the inker. Written by Fabian... I'm going to kill a name again. Nikiza. Okay.
That's the only name I recognize. The other two I've never heard of.
So...
What year was this?
This was 1994.
Oh, okay.
So, something was happening here, probably some grand plan for some imbecile that thought that they could probably take hold of Cannonball and Boomer and somehow control X-Force. Poorly planned idea that was. Game Master's involved in this storyline somewhere. He's probably... Oh, yes, this is a crossover issue with the... let's see here. So, we've got characters from... crap, I can't remember the name of this group now. What the crap was their name? It had Nova, Speedball, New Warriors, that's what they were called.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the New Warriors, the ones that were responsible for Civil War.
Yeah.
They started off the whole Civil War problem when they went after a guy that, Nitro.
Yeah.
That they couldn't handle.
And which is an old Captain Marvel.
Yeah, which got the crap kicked out of them. So, somebody's kidnapping young mutants and young talent, basically, throughout the Marvel Universe. And trying to probably channel their powers is what they were trying to do, if I recall correctly. So,
One thing, I don't mean to interrupt you, but you said Shatterstar. Which one's Shatterstar?
Shatterstar is this guy right up here with the two swords.
Hmm.
Shatterstar showed up in the Deadpool 2 movie very briefly. Those who have seen the movie know what I'm talking about. Hmm. Funny, haha. Shatterstar is from Mojo World. And he actually says that in the movie, which is really cool.
Oh, wow.
So, for him to blatantly, flat out say, I'm from Mojo World, and, like, he says it like, well, everybody should know this, is really neat, because Mojo World is where we get Longshot from the X-Men, which Mojo, Spiral, all of these characters are very intricate and detailed characters for the X-Men that we have yet to see used in any way, shape, or form for the X-Men movies.
Mojo, to me, is the most terrifying. I mean,
the fat guy in the spider thing?
Yeah, and he didn't like spines.
Yeah.
And that's why he's always talking about was Longshot and these characters think they're superior because they have spines, and he was going out of the way to prove they weren't.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the Mojoverse is a strange little place.
Oh, it's uncomfortable. Yeah. Then when he started turning into X-Men with New Mutants, Alan Davis drew it, but that's when Betsy, Captain Britain's sister, came in, and Mojo gave her eyes because she went blind in the Captain Britain series before he joined Excalibur. And Mojo gave her eyes, but they were cameras so he could see everything in that world.
Well, and that was part of the Mojo universe, the fact that everything was a television series. It was all TV. everything he did was broadcast across television for the inhabitants of the Mojoverse. And of course, like everything in the Mojoverse, like once Mojo himself or itself, I guess, because I don't really think they ever addressed truly what Mojo was. Once Mojo was destroyed, you got Mojo 2, the sequel. I mean, everybody is a slave on the Mojoverse, all being used in gladiator style television shows.
He was nasty and cruel.
I remember there was a Mojo 5 that came along at some point or another. So, apparently there was a Mojo in the Ultimate Marvel Universe as well, who was just a really big fat guy from the looks of it. Yeah. Mojo Adams. I have no idea. I didn't read a lot of the Ultimate stuff.
Well, one thing, they're all wrong, because Shatterstar was a Kree warrior that appeared in the Inhumans, created by Doug Monk and George Perez back in 1974. So, they're all wrong. I was disappointed. No, it actually sounded like a really good character.
He was a pretty decent character. He was very arrogant, very like, you know, they actually did a pretty neat thing in the Deadpool movie where he's like, I'm just like you, but better. In every single way. And that's really kind of his attitude, his character type is that, yeah, I'm just like you, just better. In every way possible.
I've always wished I could say that.
So, I'm pretty sure he was another Liefeld creation. Liefeld created a lot of stuff with the X-Force. I mean,
well, it was his book, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was his baby, 100%. But yeah, he. Oh, that's right. Richter and Shatterstar dated too.
And Richter is?
Richter, he is a character from... this goes back to before everybody made a big deal about having gay characters in their books. This was just something that was, and I don't really remember anybody going, oh my God!
It's how it should be.
This was a gay... It was a gay relationship in the book between Shatterstar and Richter. But Shatterstar... how do they put it? Oh, here we go. They designated him his genetic bond mate. So, which is kind of a neat concept, you know, but in the Mojoverse, this is just not a thing. They don't look at it that way, you know. So, yeah, but so that was something that that they did. God, way back in. I mean, I'm reading through some things. 2009, they actually did that.
Well, that's not
so
long
think
ago.
About this. Back in 2009, they did that, and when was it that everybody made the big deal about like? DC came out just a couple years ago with like an openly gay character, and then they like killed him in the first like five panels.
Well, Obsidian was gay. That was a long time ago.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's just one of those things. And like I said, this just shows you how these characters should be written. It was something that it was just normal. Yeah. They didn't treat it like a big oh look at us look how progressive we are. This is normal. You know, that's how they should treat this stuff. Not like, oh, look at us. We're going to be super progressive instead. So, all right, ready?
All right, last one, man.
Last one. Here we go. We're going to go straight to the bottom of things. We're going to get to the bottom of this.
Ooh.
Oh, he already knows what it is without me turning it around.
I saw the back cover.
Jack's luck runs out.
I'm glad you pulled that one. That's a strange. That's actually not mine. That's my daughter's.
Really?
And
okay.
We were at Wilson's Book World. This is actually before I met you guys. You know, Wilson's, you know, is nothing but dollar boxes, which to me is heaven. And my daughter went through and she pulled it out and showed it to me. And all the characters are drawn as playing cards. You know, the king, the jack,
the queen, the jack, the king. Everybody is a playing card design.
And I was surprised because I was thinking sometimes you try to do that, people copy the playing card character and the rest of it falls flat. This one all the way through, I think it was Top Shelf that did that. Or
distributed by Top Shelf.
Yeah. Well, I think they're the ones that did it. But I've never heard of this book. I've never seen any like it. And like I said, Holly picked it out, showed it to me. I'm like, well, that's unique. I read it. The closest thing I can say to our style is Chris Ware, but it's not exactly. But it's a measured style. Holly contacted me, and she wanted me to pull out some books for her to send up there. So I opened up her comic box and saw that, pulled it out, and read it again. It's in Vegas, and it's basically a married couple. And I guess it's been a while since I reread it, but the guy, the married couple's not having much luck. I mean, they're kind of living in squalid conditions. And then he meets an old employer, which is the king. And he's a real shiesty character, takes the wife out, trying to get her to leave. All these things ensue. It's peculiar. It's the art and the story go good together. I've never seen anything else like it. It's, I guess, a standalone story. Come to find out, it was a project for a college kid.
Really?
Yeah, and I'll have the more information on a link on the blog. But basically, he just wanted to see if he could do it, and he did. And I don't think he's done any more comics since. To me, it's more special comics. It's easy to get lost. I've never heard of it. Like I said, my daughter found it at a dollar box. And I just find... I love stuff like this, you know. It was never became anything. It's just... It was a lot of work.
This is a crazy story. This is so neat how it's drawn and everything.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's very flat. This is really, really interesting the way that he did this.
But the characters, I can't stress, they're playing card characters that he drew.
Yeah.
But they fit the look and personality of the real world.
Yeah. Yeah, this is quite a neat book.
And it was a lot of work. I mean, it's not like he just had some gimmick and did it. It's the story says something. It's a story everybody's kind of seen and read before on movies and other books. It's kind of a film noir type, but it's drawn in a style like
it's such an interesting style to draw in. I mean, and yeah, the storyline in the end, it's super interesting the way that he did that.
Yeah, well, they have Stereo Comics, which I forgot about. I don't think I've ever read, but it's the second strip in it. It's okay. It's I don't know. I'm glad you picked this, and I've always had this out. Want to talk about it now? I can finally put it back in my daughter's stupid box with her stupid bags and boards.
Oh, that's so funny.
So anyway, I don't keep anything in bags and boards, but my daughter keeps everything in it, and I'm like, it's hard to read now. So anyway. All right, Matt. Well, listen, this has been beautiful. I've asked this before. If you'd like to do a cover for the Facebook group announcing the episode, feel free to let us know. If you want ideas, contact me. If you got one, just send it in through the contact page. And if you don't, we still love you anyway. Anyway, thanks for listening. In the meantime,
read more comics.